Good morning. Welcome. My name is Raina Wells, and I am the Director of Business Affairs and Research at Ontario Media Development Corporation. On behalf of OMDC, I'm delighted to welcome you this morning to the first Digital Dialogue Breakfast of the year. I'm sure that many of you know OMDC, but for those of you who aren't familiar with us, we are an agency of the Government of Ontario, and our mandate is to build Ontario's creative economy through a range of innovative programs and funding for the book and magazine publishing, film, television, music, and interactive digital media industries. We're proud that Ontario has a strong track record of support for our thriving creative industries, and that OMDC has the privilege of being part of that support. At these breakfast sessions, we're continuing the conversation that starts at our annual January Digital Dialogue Conference, where we explore topics that are of interest across the media industries. What we're hoping is that someone from, for example, the music sector will hear an idea that someone in the book industry is doing and be able to take that idea and apply it to their own industry and their own products. We also do the breakfast to give people from different industries the opportunity to meet each other and perhaps eventually collaborate on a project. I've heard, in fact, from people who attended last year's breakfast sessions that they ended up partnering with someone that they had met for the first time at one of the breakfasts. This morning's session is Beyond the Shelf, Reaching Your Audience in the Digital Marketplace. Deb Day is the founder and president of Toronto-based digital media company, Innovate by Day. Deb is a storyteller, creating custom interactive content to extend story worlds. She and her team develop, create and implement digital media strategies and content, run social media campaigns, and build and manage online communities. Their clients range from individuals to organizations, producers to broadcasters. Some of the television series that they've worked on include Rookie Blue, Saving Hope, Call Me Fitz, Remedy, and Cracked. Please join me now in welcoming Deb Day and the rest of our panel.
Thanks, Raina. It's wonderful to be here, and thank you all for getting up so bright and early. It's great. I'd like to introduce you to my fellow panelists. To my far left, we have Nathan Laurie. Since 1994, Nathan has used a variety of media to help companies reach university students, and he currently runs Job Postings Magazine, Canada's largest career lifestyle magazine, and jobpostings.ca, Canada's largest student job board, helping post-secondary students find their first internships, co-ops, and entry-level jobs in their careers. Alongside his brother, Mark Laurie, Nathan also is co-founder of Passion Inc., which currently does business in over 27 countries, and owns the Job Postings magazine, jobpostings.ca, and Target Student Marketing and Apply to Education. Nathan is also a recipient of many business and entrepreneurship awards. Next to Nathan is James. James is VP Marketing of Last Gang Records, and he is also in charge of artists and repertoire. James really oversees most of the operations and all the marketing campaigns of the company, and you may have heard of Metric or Death from Above, 1979. A couple of very high-profile releases, and you got your training at RTA. And next to me is Aaron. Aaron Creasy is the Sales and Marketing Director at ECW Press and is currently the President of the Association of Canadian Publishers. Aaron is on the faculty of the Book Publishing Certificate Program at Ryerson University, and regularly works with Canadian publishers as a mentor and professional development speaker. So I'm in great company here. What we're going to do is we're going to have each person present a case study, and then after that we will open up the floor for questions. All right? Nathan, would you begin? Do you need this?
Sure. Can everyone hear me okay? Okay. So I'm going to kind of go over kind of the history of how we got started, and then the emphasis for change, and then how we got involved in the digital world from the paper world, which I still love. Okay. When my brother and I graduated from Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, we had this crazy idea. Why not start a magazine to help our friends and fellow students find jobs? 4 months later, with zero publishing experience, the first issue of Job Postings Magazine was launched in October of 1998. 6 months after that, we produced the same magazine in the United States, distributing our magazine to over 600 colleges in the U.S. Between 1999 and 2009, we grew our team and published 10 issues in Canada and 8 issues in the United States. During this time, business was great, and I personally didn't feel the need to build a digital footprint. However, in Q4 of 2008, the financial crisis in the U.S. began to affect our clients. Many of them were downsized, and the ones that remained had zero budget for advertising. The U.S. economy began to tank, and by January of 2009, advertising budgets dried up completely. We couldn't sell an ad to anyone, let alone our most loyal customers. And in a bold move, I took our January, February, March, and April sales and combined that into a spring issue. And that was our final issue in the U.S. We shut down Job Postings USA, losing over $1 million in annual revenue overnight. The change in the U.S. economy had changed my world forever, and we were done doing business in the U.S. Now I had to focus on ensuring that we didn't lose our Canadian business too. I kept my pulse on what was happening in the U.S., south of the border, and the biggest issue I saw was that U.S. recruiters had been forced to become innovative in how they recruited students. They had to do more with less. They started using websites like Craigslist, which, as we know, was a category killer for U.S. newspapers, Canadian newspapers, for their classified sections. They also started posting jobs on free social media websites like Facebook and Twitter. Luckily in Canada, print was still very valued by recruiters, by advertisers in 2009, and there were still budgets for print. I had some time to transition our business and build an online presence, but I just didn't know how long. We hired a third-party company to redo our website, and I wanted the website to look cool and hip so that after, you know, my team would call on a company, usually that person would go to our website to learn more about us. However, our strategy hadn't really changed much. We were still selling the print, but giving the web away for free. And these slides kind of show a little bit about what our websites used to look like from, as you can see, 2011. Oh, I went one too far, if you're able to go back one. Not sure if you can, but... Oh, I can do it. There we go. And update the look, so you can see the look. Now, after the 2011 update was completed, I knew that focusing mainly on print sales was the wrong strategy. And it took me quite some time to realize that. However, for the next 2 years, we were still making money with the magazine, but we began to lose customers to our online competitors. And by October of 2012, I finally sat down with our team to come up with a new strategy to see Job Postings reinvent itself into a full media company. We reached out to the OMDC. We actually got some funding through the OMDC Magazine Fund, which I'm grateful for. And in 2013, we worked to redesign our website and launch a mobile app. So in June 2013, we launched the new Job Postings website, which you can see. The new site is very visual. It's got a lot of imagery. We've got job ads alongside photos. There's lots of traditional spaces for our advertisers to advertise on. And we've also got a lot of special sections created for employer branding opportunities. Our mobile app was also launched. Oops, wrong way. Our mobile app was also launched in 2013. And since the launch of both our website and the app, we've begun the transformation from being perceived as Job Postings Magazine to being known as the Job Postings Network. I want to conclude with some lessons learned that we've, you know, beyond the printed word in the last 18 months. In the past, we used to sell ink on a page, and the process of the selling cycle was way simpler than it is today. Today, our clients want more than just a print ad. Today, our clients want, they want to be woven into the fabric of our website. They want their message broadcast on social media channels. They expect all their content to be available on a mobile and tablet. They want live events that get them face-to-face with their target audience, and they want everything to be measured and tracked. A lot different than just selling an ad. And our new philosophy at work is, if you can't measure it, don't do it. Today, there's greater pressure on our clients to show their bosses an ROI on their investment with us. And we're investing a lot of time into tracking everything we do for our clients. We need to show them an ROI if we expect them to stay with us. Now, as a way of immersing our readers into our brand, we're starting to do live events. This is a young women's networking breakfast that we hosted, and we brought together a lot of young, talented students to network with employers, and we had a panel of distinguished young women women leaders to talk about their careers and allow everyone to network in the room. We're also developing deep partnerships with student clubs on campus. These clubs are distributing our magazines at conferences, we're speaking at their events, and we're building our brand with tomorrow's student leaders. Now, a lot of our readers, because of the age group, like 16 to 24, they're using social media all the time. So our goal is to design messages that resonate and build likes and followers. We currently have over 36,000 Twitter followers and over 65,000 likes on Facebook. Now, these numbers, they give our clients the confidence that we know what we're doing in this marketplace. In the past 12 months, we've made it a priority to also build registered users to our website. And we're doing that through contests. So in conclusion, we can no longer just be a magazine. It's not an option anymore if we want to stay in business. So we've made the effort to make that transformation. And today, I'd say Job Postings is a niche player. We engage with our readership, which are students, and introduce them to our clients, who are employers who want to reach students in authentic and creative ways. So I want to thank you for spending your morning listening to my presentation. I hope you take something away from it that's helpful. And I also want to thank David Tull in the room, my communications manager, for helping me with this speech. And I couldn't be up here without an amazing team back at the office. Thank you.
Thanks. Aaron, I would love for you to share with us what you're doing at ECW.
Great. Thanks. Good morning, everyone. There we go. Great. So I know that this room doesn't have a lot of book people in it. So I wanted to touch a little bit on what our company is quickly, and also just a super one-second broad stroke of what the book industry looks like right now in Canada. So ECW, we say, stands for Entertainment, Culture, and Writing, and those are the kind of books that we do. So you can see that they fit into a whole bunch of different categories, everything from pop culture, TV, science fiction books, pop science, memoir, and literary fiction and poetry, mystery. We even have some women's fiction. What this means is that we have a very diverse audience that we're trying to reach. We have a lot of different communities that we need to target with our marketing efforts, and our readers are scattered in a whole bunch of different places, and the media we use to reach them is basically different for each and every book that we publish. It's a challenge, but it also means that what I get to do in my job is very exciting, because we can experiment with a lot of different ways to reach our audience. And our key markets for ECW are Canada and the US, as well as other English language countries around the world. So this is a stat from BookNet Canada. 1 in 3 Canadians buy a book each month, which sounds like great news. However, where are people buying those books? This is also from BookNet, and it's just showing 2012 over 2013. But here you can see, just even over the past 2 years, how the online market is edging out the bookstore market, and other in there is taking up more and more as well. The typical Canadian is buying their books from that other zone right now, and that means Costco or Walmart or other mass merch places where they have very few books to choose from. So they maybe have 100 SKUs or 200 SKUs, as opposed to a traditional bookstore where people would be able to go in and see a whole bunch of different kind of books and browse and choose. So this means that people can't actually necessarily see our books in the places they would normally look for them. So we have to find another way to reach them. So two things that we're doing at ECW. This is something we started back in January 2012. It's our Get the eBook Free initiative. So we started printing this logo on the back of all of our print books. You can see it at the bottom there. And then it says details inside. And this is a close-up of what we would print on the back page of one of our books. And it gives our philosophical statement why we think that people who are paying a premium for the print book should get the eBook Free. And people have to email us, so this is all entirely manual process for us. They email us a note, they tell us where they bought the book, and this starts off our direct reader engagement, something that up until this point we did not have access to. We didn't know where people were buying our books or necessarily who they are. So now we see this and we start a correspondence with them. We send back their file, we ask to add them to an email newsletter list, and then we also say in our response to them, we ask them to post reviews on various retailer sites. The feedback we have got from this over the last 2 years has been absolutely tremendous. People, readers, book buyers love it. They post all kinds of positive things about us on social media, how nice we are, isn't that great? but this conversation is happening in all kinds of different places. So it's happening on Twitter, it's happening on retailer sites, it's happening on places like Goodreads and Reddit. So we see comments about our program all over the place. Then what we do is we create newsletters to keep these customers in our loop and follow up. And they're based on the kind of book that the person claimed their free ebook for. So we're not just sending out stuff on all of our books to these people. It's very targeted. So, for example, last year, one of our best-selling titles was the book Clockwork Angels. And it's based on the Rush album Clockwork Angels. And the book is a novel written by Neil Peart and Kevin J. Anderson. It's a bit of steampunk sci-fi. So all the people who bought and claimed their free ebook for Clockwork Angels got the opportunity to enter a contest for an exclusive signed book. But they also learned about some of our other books that they probably didn't know about before. So a nonfiction book about first guitars, for example, that included Alex Lifeson's first guitar, some of our other science fiction books, that kind of thing. So that is one quick example. We've given away about 2,300 ebooks to date over this program. It's just a small fraction of the number of books that we've sold, and it hasn't cut into our ebook sales at all. People are really choosing to buy one format or the other, typically not both. And I would also say that it's been great for indie stores that don't have access to the ebook market because they have a bonus to offer their customers when they sell them one of our print books. So it's been very positive all around. The other thing, I'm going to go back, that I'll quickly touch on. Oh, I'm going the wrong way. Okay. that I'll quickly touch on is Taylor Swift fan fiction. So this is totally different. But another way that we've been reaching out to our audience, we publish nonfiction books, pop culture, and this is an example of a book that came out last spring and sold mostly into these mass merch accounts in Canada and the U.S. that I was talking about. We had about 25,000 copies out in the world. And the authors, the author is actually two people, the authors agreed to write fan fiction, so made up stories about Taylor, and post them on the site Wattpad, which has a huge readership, and anyone can post their content up there. So their 19 parts has currently over 283,000 reads. This was all being posted while the authors were writing the book. So very exciting way to reach out to the audience. We also tried it with a mystery book. So this is a first novel that came out about 4 years ago, Dead Politician Society. And there's also Rob Ford fan fiction that she's trying to write. But Robin decided to post the first book, all the short chapters, in individual parts. We have sold about 1,000 copies in print of this book and 500 in digital when the book first came out. It really had tapered off to nothing. over 310,000 reads, and this is happening right now in the moment. So she's still posting the chapters. What we decided to do is a cover redesign so we can rebrand the series, and we're going to have the Wattpad, all these Wattpad readers vote on the new look for the book, and then we're going to re-release all of the series at once in digital format with the new covers. And the hope is that all of these readers are going to be so into the book that they're going to buy the second and third books in the series. So that's TBD. I guess my talk could really be summed up as giving stuff away for free, but I but at the same time we are selling a lot of books, so these are some of the experiments we're trying in the digital realm to expand our audience.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'll go next. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to speak to you about Saving Hope. Saving Hope is a television series that started last summer, June 2012. Yeah, June 2012. And we were engaged to become the digital and social media producers. So, there we go. So our role, we wanted to first understand the objective of the network, which was to drive viewers to the show. And second to that was also to have people discover the show and its offerings online. And this was a new initiative for Bell Media to really launch a very comprehensive digital media accompaniment with a series. So the first thing that we did once we understood what the goals were was really understand what the assets were connected with the project. The first thing we identified was the cast. We had three lead actors, Erica Durant, Michael Shanks, and Danielle Gillies, all of whom came with a fabulous fan base thanks to genre television. Genre television is wonderful for creating really rabid fans and fanatics about certain cast members. So here they were transitioning from that genre into, fairly mainstream drama. The next thing we identified as being, we thought would be compelling and of interest to the audience was the music that they were using. Each episode was going to be featuring an original Canadian mostly, but not always, song that we thought really amplified the emotion and the connection with the content. And then the third thing we identified that we thought audiences were going to really be interested in were the story world relationships. It was about the drama of the characters. So we built out from there. So here we go. We know that we want to drive people to CTV, to the CTV social app, their mobile site, and to video on demand. How do we do this? Well, we decided to create a lot of content. So we have the 13 episodes for the series. That was the television ones. And then what we produced in addition to that were 70 exclusive videos, 100 feature articles, lots of photo galleries of all sorts, from episodic to behind the scenes, caption contest polls and quizzes, and I'm going to get into all what they were, and then web journals, a music lounge, interactive live chats, and an in-character account. So here is what happened. So what we knew was when we were looking at developing where we were going to be and how we were going to do it, we're like, okay, where is our audience and how do we bring them into CTV.ca? Because of the focus that we were talking about, we identified, really, that we would have to find people in their space. And in this case, we knew that Facebook and Twitter were going to be the two key tickets. And eventually, we convinced as well the network that YouTube would be another space for discoverability. So we identified that. And that's where we, how and where we rolled out our content in order to drive people back in to CTV. We ended up with a very, I think I've lost the slide, but let's see. Yeah, okay, here we go. So Saving Hope debuted number one with in Canada with 1.5 million viewers on CTV, which was the highest rated launch of series that year in both the Canada and the U.S. And then in social media, they felt it was a good big success because every 4 seconds CTV was mentioned, so and or Saving Hope. But how did we sustain and continue to grow it? Because that was the other trick. We had an amazing, amazing, and I can't undervalue the campaign that CTV did. You couldn't go anywhere without noticing that Saving Hope was going to be on television, right? I mean, it was domination on the subways and so forth. But those two main campaigns were in major city centers. So outside of that, we also saw an audience. But what we learned and what worked really well was, remember I told you we had identified music? So I don't know if David is here. David Heyman, are you in the house? He was planning to be here. No. We worked really closely with the music supervisor to create original content that was going to help really both grow the show and support the musicians or the artists. So for each episode, we would create a music video using the song, the featured song from that episode, but with the entire show content. And eventually we were able to launch both the music video and on YouTube and on the station and on Facebook and so forth. And what ended up resulting was really neat. And we have a little case study here. We call this like the 360 effect, where we've got our television network. And from that, we've got all the different ways you can watch it. But what we did was we took our super trailer, and in this case, let's say it was Andy Brown was our artist. He ended up sharing and talking with his fan base and his community and so forth on YouTube, Twitter, and other social platforms. We were talking about Saving Hope, but as it related to Andy Brown, on all of ours. And what we ended up seeing were fans of Andy Brown's coming to Saving Hope, but even quite nicely and quite happily for Andy Brown, he saw a very big uptick in his record sales. In fact, let me just figure out, I've got my little information on how good that was for him. So he took a 3.5-year-old album that had already charted and reached the top 20, and it came up again to that level. He saw his newsletter subscription rate go up by 10%. He saw a sales bump of 25% to the earlier 3 months prior, and his single sales on iTunes reached just shy of 10,000. So that was a really nice uptick, and for me it was a great example of what we're really trying to do when we're thinking about how do we cross-promote and really help each other out. The other thing we realized that worked was, remember I said that relationships and extending story world was really important? So the main character, Alex, or Erica Durance, her husband-to-be is in a coma in the first season. And so we thought, how can we get into the head of the character? And I said, well, let's think about writing a blog or a journal, which talks to her inner feelings about what's really going on for her while Charlie is in the coma. We couldn't believe the number of hits people that we received on this. And I think that part of it was people who were enjoying the show wanted to know more about what was happening for that character, and it did really work. When you were saying, Nathan, that imagery and photography are important, we found that was the case as well, and I'm sure that all of you who work in digital space have found that as well. And it really does drive people's conversation. So a couple of things that we did other than putting up episodic photographs, we actually ran a few caption this contests, and fans really loved it. You know, they were very engaged in the show, and now they wanted to put their own words to it, and we would award people each week. We often wouldn't give anything out other than a big shout out and then create their caption onto the image of the show. And it worked really well in terms of people sharing and spreading. And that was another key component. We realized that as much and wherever we could, all the content that we would make had to be shareable. I know that, you know, it's often been thought to hold on to your assets and drive people to you. Well, the more you can share it out, the more they will come back to you, was our discovery. Articles, again, really, really great sort of insights to how the show was made, what was happening in the cast lives outside of the show, who they were, and so forth was great. And one of the things we did is when we were shooting our behind-the-scenes videos, we would also extend that interview a bit, and so we were able to create articles at the same time as creating videos, and those were also very, very effective for us. Lessons learned. Okay, so one of the things that we did was we created a web series. Now, web series actually work very well most of the time, and we've been involved with many shows that have them. However, where we made a mistake, I will acknowledge, on this one, or maybe missed the mark, was coming back to what we knew or thought we knew about our audience, that they wanted to extend story worlds. What we created with the web series, while it was got decent numbers, the web series was just a bit different than the show itself. So it was an extension of the characters, but it wasn't really an extension of the full story world, the way the blog was, you know, kind of getting into her head. This was set around a character who had this fictitious Ask Gavin kind of self-help thing. He was a psychiatrist for staff to get advice. So while it was cute and fun, it just didn't expand the world because it was so kind of tangential. We did tie it in with some story parts, that was a given, but it just didn't connect. In season two, the web series that was created was called Last Call, which takes place in a bar, and it's like they're debriefing about their day and their lives. Big hit. I also think that in a first season, when you're just ramping up and getting to know characters, stay very, very true to that world, because that's what the audience tends to want to see. Facebook ads, fantastic. Don't start them earlier. I don't know, maybe we'll talk about that. We found them extremely effective. We were only able to bring them in a bit later, just due to the way things work with the network, but it really worked very well to help grow our audience. And another lesson learned was, as you can see, this was a pretty, well, I wouldn't go epic fail, but it certainly wasn't, it was not the success we had hoped. We created an in-character Twitter account based around one of the characters. And while the writing was great, and we used writers from inside the story room on the show, again, the audience wasn't ready to start thinking about this character as a Twitterer. They were far more interested in hearing from the show creators and the actual cast members about the world and not interested in the fictitious character in this case. We have seen it work on other shows, but in this one, it really didn't. So I hope that kind of gives you some sampling as to what our lessons learned were in terms of creating transmedia or digital media as connected with a film and television property. Thank you. So last but not least, we have James.
Hi. So I'm going to talk I guess about what Last Gang is doing in our physical retail space. Just because in the last 10 years, ever since iTunes started, physical sales have been going down, digital sales have been going up, but what exactly are we doing to still capture those physical sales? The reality in the music space is that there really isn't shelf space anymore for records, especially in the indie world, which is really where we play a lot in. We're not selling millions of records, we're selling thousands of records, sometimes 100,000 records, but you know, 2,000 records, 5,000 records is a good day, and then 10,000 and 50 is fantastic. So I think the biggest thing for us is understanding who our audience is. Who is the music consumer? Who's buying physical CDs? And the problem right now is that, you know, where do you play a CD? You play a CD in a car, you play a CD in a computer, and you play a CD in a stereo. But cars are switching over to satellite radio, or they'll have an iPod jack. Stereos are now becoming iPod hubs. And computers, well, you have streaming music. You can listen to essentially anything on Deezer, RDO, even YouTube right now. So how can we capture that physical audience still to this day, but use digital technology to our advantage? One of the main things that we wanted to do is figure out a way to make music a lot more tangible. If you're going to go out and buy something and pay for something, you want that sense that you're, what you're paying for is valuable. And because of digital music, because of access to music online, a lot of the actual music has kind of been devalued because it's so readily available. So in order to make that physical product something more valuable, we've gone and made limited edition vinyl, limited number of pressings, whether it's 300 copies, 1,000 copies, 5,000 copies. Record Store Day, which is a new initiative that was launched by the independent record stores, is really trying to bring people back into the retail stores for those limited products in order to bring them in, buy one item, maybe you're going to buy five items. Using that kind of tangible ideal, we also are able to create specific initiatives per release still around the CD. When we're selling digital singles leading up to a release, or I guess my case study is a band from the UK called Dark Horses, we put out three digital singles early on worldwide. The band wasn't going to be here in North America, but we were able to do the proper press campaign, build up a good enough audience, selling thousands of singles across North America, that we were then able to take that digital data from iTunes. So if you buy something from iTunes, your postal code, your area, it all gets tracked. We're able to take that information from our distributors, direct from iTunes, and actually target where our largest audiences are. So by targeting our largest audiences, we were able to pick 15 different locations across North America where we can go and give people an incentive to actually go out to the stores the day that the actual album is out and purchase the record. And so our idea was to make a cassette. It's a novel idea because I can't even find my cassette player, but we actually had amazing results. We made 200 cassettes. We got the band to sign all of them. Sometimes the band fingerprinted them. It was really an interesting and neat initiative for Canadian audiences, American audiences, for a band from the UK. But we were able to specifically target right around North America where the largest amount of fans were. And through social media, through Last Gang social media, the band's social media, and as well as the record stores, we were able to go out and say, if you go to Soundscapes in Toronto and you're one of the first 10 people, 15 people, to buy this CD, then you will get the cassette. And it's signed and it's limited edition. And to be completely honest, within that first week, we sold out of every single cassette and every single CD through that initiative. It's not a lot, but for a band that is from the UK, that normally we would see a 30-70 split digital-physical, we actually were able to see a much higher 30-70 split, but in favor of the physical product on this release. So that's just one initiative that we did. The other way that we're really targeting is, again, finding your audience. So for Last Gang, we have a new artist called Ryan Hemsworth. He just was on tour in Australia for 16 dates. All of them were sold out between 200 and 600 people. Normally, we would have limited physical distribution in Australia just because the market really there is very small, especially for a Canadian company to have the proper distribution. With CDs, a lot of CDs, well, all CDs are returnable. So for us to go into a market like that, there's a lot of money that has to be put into place as far as creating the physical product, marketing the physical product at retail. And then at the end of the day, if you don't sell it, it all gets returned. So to have that money tied up into physical product and not know whether you're going to sell it or not, it's not really ideal for a company our size. So what we did instead is, using the digital technology, in-house we were able to reach out directly to key retailers within those touring markets across Australia, and we were able to ship about 500 CDs and vinyl combined to Australia, to those key retailers, and really have that sell-through because of the tour. And it literally was just based on an email address through digital technology. It's not as difficult as it might seem. It's not as far out of reach as it might seem. It takes some time, but there really are benefits, and you're creating that direct relationship with the store, and you're able to convey exactly what you want the store to tell the customers. So we're able to market through Ryan's channels, through Last Gang's channels, and again, tell fans that if you are in Australia, if you're going to this show and you want to pick up this record, then it's available here at this store. And it's a old approach, and it's a direct approach, but it's been really effective for us in the physical space. The other thing, identifying where we're selling physical CDs and physical vinyl, right now, a large majority, probably 50% of our actual physical retail is through touring, is off stage. So because of that,
I'm out of time.
I'm getting cut off.
No? Wrap up.
Okay, I was just gonna say, normally in the past where you would have an actual sales account or account rep manager for physical retail, we've replaced that job with a touring logistics person. So basically we have someone now on staff that teaches bands, teaches artists best practices for retail at their shows, in order to make sure that they constantly have CDs, and we're able to actually increase their offstage sales because of that.
Sorry. Thank you.
Thanks.
I don't know, it's kind of interesting to hear how sometimes some of the old great ideas are new and work again. And it really does point to me that it really is about also in each case, really understanding who the audiences are that you're trying to reach and where they are and how to reach them and how to kind of innovate the ways to do that, to keep them being loyal, as you have determined, loyal, I think in all cases, really. It's about building a loyalty, isn't it? Do we have any questions?
Do you have a question, Maria?
Yes. Yeah. It was for you. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Can you talk a little bit about how you helped CTV publish 70 videos on YouTube, and what kind of negotiation was involved there?
With who? With CTV?
Yeah, I'd be interested in knowing that. And also, how much did you spend on the web series, and was it enough?
So, so first question was, that was a difficult negotiation, because it's about drawing people back to them. But what we were able to show them was that we felt there was a missed opportunity if we weren't there. And so we put out bits of content, and as that began to demonstrate that to them, they warmed up to the idea. Now, whether or not that, I don't know what their policy is currently, because we're not on the show right now. But it is tough, right? And the web series, though, there was some content that remained exclusive to CTV, for example, the web series. And in terms of exactly how much the web series cost, I don't remember, but it wasn't expensive, because we were able to use the cast who were in the show, approximately, maybe $100,000? It wasn't a lot of money, right? Because we did pay the writers and we paid everybody, but we were able to shoot it in a day or two, right? And we shot it all in one mostly all in one location.
Was it
about
funds for the web series?
No, CMF. Yeah. Yes.
James.
Yes.
How are you?
Good. How are you, James?
With the rollout that you've done, it's great. You told me a lot about, told us a lot about the things you did, but I'm curious about how you actually reached those people. What was the frequency of how you reached them? I mean, was it a tweet a day? Was it two tweets a day? What did you target when you tweeted? Were there tweets and not Facebook posts, or there were Facebook posts less often? I'm really curious about the strategy as opposed to the tactics. And I wonder if you can fill me in on some of those things.
I mean, realistically, at the time of those campaigns, I think Twitter and Facebook were the most active. Instagram right now we're using a lot more because it's a visual medium, but that really was Facebook and tweeting. It was a combination of pretty much, you know, two tweets a day, one Facebook, a little bit budget allotted to an actual Facebook ad boost with, you know, the nice nice picture of the cassette or of the vinyl, depending on the situation. And it was mostly through the Facebook advertising that got the largest boost, but it was through repetition of Twitter, through the band's account and through our own account, actual dialogue between the bands and the retail stores when we were able to engage them. The retail stores, in particular for the Dark Horses campaign, you know, we targeted them based on where their audience was, but also based on either existing relationships with those stores or stores that actually really wanted the product. So someone like Soundscapes here, they're fantastic. They want to support Last Gang however they can, and so they will tweet back and all that kind of stuff to really engage the audience.
Question right there.
I think this time I won't
wait for the mic. Okay. Oh, here it is. It's right here.
First of all, thank you very much for your presentation. It's very candid and practical. My question is, you talked about measuring the impact of a campaign. Has anyone done cost analysis of what it costs to do a social, the real cost of a social media campaign? Because you're on all the time, and how long it carries on, and there isn't really an end date, it just keeps going on and on. So has anyone done that, especially when you're doing it yourself within your company? Nathan, you might have something.
When we started, we used to use, I guess, an intern full-time. They would come on four-month rotations. And, you know, you start with 500 legs, and then the next intern gets it up to 1,000. And you just keep growing it. And then as you get more and more legs, the position becomes a lot more desirable, and you get a better talent pool coming in. There's been some new laws with interns, so we've had to change things around. And... now it's part of David's job, but you need, the real cost would be a salary. You know, you need you're talking anywhere from 40 to 65, probably 1,000 a year, depending on who. Plus, you need, if they're going to do it constantly, and you also got to probably put a budget towards some marketing promotions, which could also be the same amount of money.
I would add that it's not just about the messaging, it's also about the content that you're doing. It can't just be about pushing. It is so essential that it not be just constant push, message, push. It's about engagement, it's about conversation, and we really, really, really feel strongly about not using interns. Yeah.
I just have a quick question for Deb. My question is, the presentation that you just showed, is it possible for people to like have access to that presentation that you showed on a few minutes ago?
I think so. I also think that this is being recorded, so you'll...
Look at the actual PDF.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, I guess reach out via Raina, and we'll figure that out.
Okay.
All right. Yes. Oh. Okay, here, and then here. Yep.
I wanted to follow up with James about strategies of physical product. Have you done an analysis of how much, because in music you also want the live performance to be promoted. So how much does all the, have you done an analysis of the promotion of the live shows with the physical product and how it translates into both retail and off stage?
For my specific position and for my job, it's mostly just about it's primarily the record sales. We don't participate in the live aspects of the shows. So a lot of the advertising for the actual ticket sales of the shows comes directly from the actual promoters. For us, we're basically, you know, we'll sell this albums to the band, and the band will sell the records off stage. So we want to move as much product as we can physically with them. We don't have exact analysis of numbers just yet, but I know that they've increased probably by at least a quarter right now. We really just brought in the position in the last, I'd say, probably 8 months. And a majority of the touring happens in the summertime and the fall. So, you know, I know it's been successful. I just don't have the exact numbers on that. But we are evaluating it. We have used the OMDC as well for assistance, and we'll be doing reports and stuff like that.
One here and then here. Yep.
Hi, question for Aaron. I know at ECW you guys do companion books to series sometimes, sort of two parts. Do you ever do books as a companion while the series is still on its current run, or do you mm-hmm. do them only after the fact? And if you do them during the run, do you see that driving sort of any new viewership to the current series?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. We actually do both. So we publish a lot of companion guides for TV shows. The real trick in reaching the audience is having an author who's really engaged in the fan community for that particular show. So an example of a series that we have going on right now is a companion to The Vampire Diaries. And that's coming out always at the start of the next season, and it's a printed book about the previous season. The author is very well connected now with obviously the fan base, but also the showrunners and creators of the show. Like the season 5 book will have a foreword from Kevin Williamson, for example. So while they're unofficial books, when the books are coming out at the same time, we can really engage the people who are on the show and the audience as well. We also do books after the fact. So one coming out this spring is a companion to Breaking Bad. And it's meant to be for diehard fans, but also for people who are just starting to watch the show. So there's like episode recaps and things like that. Again, the authors have been, for the whole run of the show, very engaged in the fan community, and all of that is happening online. I would also add the social media component there. It doesn't really work if we do it from ECW. Like you can see from our list, it's too diverse. We're not a brand that people are ever going to understand or look for. It's all about how we can help the authors promote themselves and promote themselves in the fan community, whether going to fan conventions, putting advertising on all different kinds of fan sites for particular shows. So each one of those shows that we have companion book to is going to have a very unique and different audience from the next.
I'm going to add that we spend a lot of time working with the creators and the cast to really own their own voice and to engage online as well. It's really essential. Mm-hmm. You have a question. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I guess it's for Aaron and James because I'm really interested about the way you guys are.
Question for Aaron and James. Go ahead.
So I was interested in your guys' kind of creative strategies to increase the physical sales, and I wondered to you guys, like, what is the value of the physical sales, and do you see that changing in the near future or distant future? Like, will there always be that kind of market or audience for that?
Yeah, I think well, we'll probably have very different answers. for books, definitely. I think the Canada stat for digital versus print is still under 20% overall. ECW, we're very aggressive in the digital marketplace, but we're still around that range. And I think that things are starting to level off. I don't think that we're going to see the physical book entirely disappear. What will be interesting will be the growth of maybe digital-first products that book publishers can start developing, so things that aren't just taking your book and putting it into electronic form, but adding new elements. Again, I don't think that's ever going to be a huge part of what our world is about, because people like reading it, but...
I think for music in particular, we have to be focused on physical product right now as a record label. In the States, there's at least 4 digital services that are completely free but based on just ad revenue. So iTunes Radio in the States, Spotify in the States, they're all free platforms mm-hmm. with ads. Google and YouTube are launching a similar system. So essentially, you know, we're not making as much money as a record label because we're not actually selling product. We're streaming a lot of music, but selling an actual product, we're not making any money. So we need to really focus on physical and how we can capture that audience again. And I'd look to actually books and publishing and see what they've done. You know, the concepts of having the hardcover come out first and then the paperback afterwards, and how we can translate those kind of thoughts to music.
Okay, who's got the microphone?
I got the microphone. I just have a quick question for the panel. How do you guys access funding, and how does that, like, do you guys have an internal person that does the application for you, or you guys...
Is it to everybody?
Yes, for the, like, accessing CMF and OMPC funding.
We do it, usually, in conjunction with, but there are triggers, right? You'd have to have the broadcaster on side, so we've done a lot of the funding applications for our creative partners.
Yeah, for books, we do everything ourselves in office between me and another person.
Yep, we have people on staff, internal.
Yeah, same with us, we do it internally.
Great. Two more questions, yep. Oh, here, sorry, we have a mic here.
For Nathan, just wondering if you have your audience segmented, or do you have print only, do you have web, do you actually know what the breakdown is, and I guess more importantly, how do you then present that to advertisers?
Okay. With print, it's impossible to know the breakdown because it's a free magazine that's drop shipped onto 100 plus campuses across Canada. So we have contacts at every school that distribute the magazine, and we know how many copies are being used, because if there's too many, they ask us to ship less. It's like a stew, and you're constantly stirring it. We have someone full-time in the office in touch with our distributors on campus to make sure we're not dumping magazines. With the web, it's much more easy to track your audience with registered users. They fill out a profile of what school they go to, what year of study they're in. We ask male, female, and so it's much more easier. And then also even with social media, like on Facebook, we know our followers. We can get all that demographic. We can now, with 65,000 followers, we can geo-target our posts. So for our going back to the advertisers, I think that your question was, how do we use that information when we're selling? We take a consultative approach where we now go in with a rate card that is... four packages, you know, at different price points, very similar to what we used to have in print. So if a full page ad was $5,000 for one issue, we've actually changed it. We're charging $7,500 for a year, but we bundle in the full page ad, but then we give them a bunch of digital opportunity as well for an entire year. So what's changed for us is the selling cycle, where we used to sell into a September issue. Maybe that sale was made in August or July. We can go to them at any time in the year when they have their budget, give them an annual campaign, and then they happen to go into that one issue at that time. It's working. It's working really, really well, because it allows us to compete with all the digital platforms that are out there, and we've been able to differentiate ourselves from a LinkedIn, which is a competitor, or a Workopolis, which would be a competitor. Simply because our site is a very unique site that meshes not just a posting, but actual content. Mm. So we looked back at who we were, and which was always content delivery, relevant information to students to help them with the career transition from school to work, how to write a resume, how to write a cover letter. And then we bundle all that information along with jobs from our clients that are on the site. And where the monetization in the olden days with job boards used to be the postings, which companies would pay for and still do on a site like Workopolis, we're now using jobs as content, and it helps to monetize traffic to the site, because we're about 150,000 students a month coming to the site. And then we're using that number to then go to our advertisers and say, we can promote your brand, your employer brand, and reach the students that you want on our website. And we do that by giving them a profile that we host their video. We actually integrate through widgets all of their Twitter live Twitter feeds into the accounts. You can see it on our site, and I can talk to you guys about it later.
I have to apologize.
Sorry if that took too long.
No.
I hope that was helpful.
Clearly, there's a lot to be discussed here. I'm really excited about the conversation. I have to apologize because when I agreed to do this, I have to run off to something immediately. So, but I am accessible. Julia and Amy, can you stand up? Just because if somebody wants to speak to anybody who works with me, they're right here. They can stay around for a few more minutes, okay? If it's pressing, or you can reach me via the, you know, our address. But I want to acknowledge and thank everybody for coming out. I want to thank the OMDC for putting this together. My fellow panelists are able to stay around for a little bit. Is that right? Is that accurate? Yes?
Yeah.
To answer some questions, but I do apologize, but I thank you so much for coming in. I know there's people who also have to leave, so thank you very much.